Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's show. My name is Mitch Walsh. You're listening to a brand new live newsflash episode here on the show today. It's a pleasure to be back with you. We are starting with a pretty important and pretty interesting story that's probably going to shape the way a lot of people in America will be living in the future. It comes around abortion, with states all across the country planning to either try and protect doctors who want to give abortions or crack down on them. It could be the full digest of some of the plans that people are kind of cooking up in states across the country. Meanwhile, Tesla workers in upstate New York are trying to unionize in the same spirit as Starbucks and Amazon workers. And we'll take a look at some of their strategies, some of the campaigns that they are doing. The Tesla shop is in Buffalo, same place where the Starbucks union originally started, and that is no coincidence. We'll tell you all about that. Also, David Sirota once again making the libs crazy with his journalism about Pete Buttigieg's handling of the railroads and some of the East Palestine train accident. We'll take a look at what he has to say about that, breaking down the fact that, yes, you know, Pete Buttigieg, the person who's in charge of regulating the railroad companies, maybe could have done a better job in holding the railroads accountable for this accident, even though, as Bernie Sanders says, he was not driving the train. Also, we'll take a look at the case for nationalizing the railroads for our last story. And gentlemen, welcome to the show. All right, so we start today with this. It's a new goal for abortion bills. This is in the New York Times, catching my eye today. David Chen writing, for the first time since the fight over abortion access was kicked to the states after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, newly elected legislatures around the country are coming into session and are putting the polarizing issue at the top of their agendas. Around 300 bills in 40 states have been proposed so far, with a majority seeking to restrict access to abortion and others trying to strengthen it. Of the bills, most of the bills are in the early stages, and many are not likely to survive politically divided state governments to make it into law. But there's one thing that is evident: the legislative flurry shows that both sides of the debate agree on at least one point. Doctors are the critical link, and that has made them the most vulnerable to punishment. And again, this is going to be some of the thing, you know, that a lot of people on the pro-choice side of things have really pushed the pro-life side to be, you know, really honest about and really open about, saying, hey, think about the logical conclusions of what you're trying to do here. If you're trying to really ban abortion, that's going to have to start to mean to punish doctors, punish women who get the abortions, and that is going to be a very, very big kind of new step, I think, for American politics and how we kind of deal with the consequences of what's been going on here. And doctors now seem to, because, I mean, you know, punishing the women who are in various states of really kind of desperate, tough situations, not the most popular thing. So they're starting with the doctors. In a bill in Wyoming, doctors and nurses who perform abortions or prescribe medication for abortion could face 5 years in prison. In Nebraska, where abortion is currently legal until 22 weeks after a woman's last menstrual period, a bill would make it illegal after around 6 weeks and would strip doctors who perform abortions of their medical licenses if they perform one after detecting cardiac activity on an ultrasound, or even if they fail to provide an ultrasound before an abortion. Our goal isn't to throw a lot of doctors in jail. Our goal is accountability. And, you know, what does that accountability look like? Well, throwing doctors in jail. That is what it looks like. And again, like, it's a very, very scary political situation, and it's just hard to see, you know, in some states, like, you know, maybe Wyoming, but this kind of stuff can survive. But in few places, I think it's going to be a really kind of test of our democracy, especially on the state level, because in few places is this stuff popular. Kansas, ruby red state, killing the pro-life referendum in big numbers in the I believe it was leading up to the midterm election, not actually on the day, but still, it shows you that a lot of people in the, you know, when you give people rights, they are not really too thrilled about giving them up, you know, accepting, of course, a large, you know, Christian minority and you know, extreme Christian minority in this country. So yes, this is a Sue Leibel which is kind of a funny name, the director of state affairs for the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America Group, which is an anti-abortion group that lobbies for restrictions and bans. More than a dozen states have already banned most abortions, and the laws punish doctors with prison and steep fines. The tactic has largely worked, and abortion providers have shut down in states with bans, and doctors in hospitals are reluctant to provide abortions until women are sick enough to qualify for exceptions that say the procedure is legal when a woman's life is in danger, which is really just horrific, horrific stuff. And we've seen these stories been put out more and more and more. And I think what really, again, this is such a critical, you hate to see it as a political issue, but like, it is so, so heartbreaking that, we have to talk about this and sort of kind of like, how is this going to affect the next election here? But just like, this is just, that is how in America, on a very slow, kind of awful way, in the ideal situation, all these people would just be really kind of, in jail or in some way kind of like really severely punished for just doing this, in my personal ideal world, they would be really severely punished for this kind of really awful, inhumane, draconian behavior. It's just horrific, horrific stuff. But, the only way, unfortunately, is just to really have a political party that is capable of saying, on the other side of this, we value basic humanity. We value, respect for women. We value, just giving people, not letting women just die. If you're really on death's door, that's when you get your abortion. No other time. Like, it is such a horrific, horrific situation. And it's just like, it's just so unbelievable to even think that this stuff's going to be happening in so many different places around the world, or around the country. I'm here in, I've mostly lived in pretty liberal states where abortion's never really been in danger from my entire life. But, obviously that is not the majority of the country by any stretch. There's still a huge kind of chunk of people who are going to be living in this kind of way. In states with bans, abortion pills have become a pretty crucial workaround. Although bans prohibit abortion by any method, including medication, pills are tougher to regulate. Before Roe was overturned, medication was already used in more than half of all abortions in the United States. Pills and their providers are increasingly becoming targets of attempts to restrict abortion. And a suit filed by anti-abortion groups in federal court in Texas is seeking to overturn federal approval of a key abortion drug. So they're pretty much going to this, federal regulatory bureaucracy here and saying, here's what we're going to do. We got to stop any possible way. If some people are kind of in a workaround type of situation, we're going to get them. We're going to find out how they're doing it, and we're going to stop this crime, this murderous crime from happening at once. And it's just not a popular position. It is clearly not a popular position, but because of the way our political system works, where we have all these states with very, very few low population people in the middle of the country, there's not a lot of people in these states, but they all get their own state legislatures. They are able to pass these bills. And they're all, all these lobbying groups that are there down to, affect the Supreme Court, which, that's a whole other can of worms about how anti-democratic this is. This is just forced on people, and they have to live this way, which is just so, brain-breakingly insane. Before Roe was overturned, medication, again, was already used in more than half of all abortions in the U.S. Pills and their providers are increasingly becoming targets of attempts to restrict abortions here. So in Iowa, where abortion is currently, again, legal after 22 weeks after a woman's last menstrual period, a new bill would make it a felony for doctors or anyone else to distribute abortion pills punishable by up to 10 years in jail. The bill would not penalize women who take or obtain the pills. So, again, you can see they're kind of working up to that point. I'm sure they'll get there at some point. I'm sure, that is their end goal in some kind of way. But they are clearly trying to make some sort of much more serious play here. And they don't, I think if you have to guess, if these people had to guess, like, they would know that it wouldn't be politically popular, probably not, the best thing to do. But they are extremists. They're committed. They're zealots on this issue. And they don't really care. They've been waiting for a long time for this moment. They've been waiting for a long time to push this on people. And push it on them they will, because that is something that they can do with their political power. These are deeply Christian, deeply fundamentalist people. who have taken control of so many levers of power, you know, on the federal level and on so many states' levels, that a lot of these bills are probably going to pass and make the kind of window of possibility on this even worse. And it's just so horrific that there just seems to be no kind of real political way to kind of campaign on it, or really kind of effective way to motivate change in a lot of these places like, you know, like places, well, Wyoming or Iowa. Like, there is no clear political movement, no clear political mobilization around how to deal with this issue, how to solve this issue. Is a very, very scary thing, because you look at this stuff, it is just horrific. Abortion rights advocates are guardedly optimistic that several states with Democratic legislatures will preserve or strengthen executive orders signed by current or previous governors, making it harder for future elected officials to change the law if political dynamics change. In Hawaii, one bill would allow physicians' assistants to perform abortions. Another would shield doctors and patients from out-of-state subpoenas relating to reproductive health and preclude doctors who perform abortions from losing their medical licenses, not unlike the one that was recently signed into law in Illinois and another that was introduced in Vermont. So, in New Hampshire, where abortion is legal until 24 weeks, though, doctors who perform them beyond that time may no longer be subject to prison sentences under newly proposed legislation. So, again, that is kind of the back and forth that we're dealing with here. People smuggled across state lines, and it's really what it's going to do is going to make, you know, some places unacceptable for some people to live in, because, you know, if you want to have an abortion, if you want basic civil rights, you're not going to be able to have them if you live in good parts of the country, good chunks of the country. And it's going to push people who admire what they're doing. Essentially what it's going to do is going to create more ideological states, more ideological lines, and essentially make, you know, what I in the back of my mind see coming as the way America falls, which is a break up into a red country and a blue country with, you know, liberal cultural values and conservative cultural values, and then, you know, the laws being obviously much more kind of Christian fundamentalist on the red side and much more, you know, I'd say California-esque on the blue side. But it is it's very, very easy to imagine when you're going to have people, you know, literally leaving states for their basic human rights, that things like that could happen. All right. We go now to our next story in Buffalo, New York, where on Tuesday, workers at a Tesla plant in Buffalo, New York, publicly launched a unionization campaign. They're seeking to work organized with the SEIU, Service Employees International Union Affiliate, Workers United. Their Tesla Workers United is the name. Workers United Upstate New York is the same union that supported workers who organized with Starbucks Workers United, SBWU. They won their first historic victory in Buffalo in December 2021 and has now won at least 286 NLRB elections in 36 states, despite facing one of the most ferocious and unlawful anti-union campaigns in living memory. The National Labor Relations Board currently has 497 open or settled unfair labor practice charges against Starbucks or its anti-union law firm Littler Mendelson. Tesla's Gigafactory 2 facility opened in Buffalo in 2017 and now employs roughly 1,000 workers and about 800 autopilot workers who are tasked with developing Tesla's self-driving cars. The inside organizing campaign started among the autopilot workers among the end of last year. It went public on Tuesday morning and may yet spread to the entire plant. If the NLRB protects the workers' choice, or if it manages to agree, or if management agrees to sign Tesla Workers United Fair Election Principles document and thus offers its workers a fair choice, the unionization campaign will likely succeed. If it doesn't, it'll become the first union at multi-billionaire Elon Musk's Tesla Inc., which has crushed every previous union effort. So that's going to be a key thing. And again, what I always say about with Joe Biden is that is one of the main reasons why you want Joe Biden. Like, that is one of the, you know, when people say, oh, you don't have to vote, you know, Republican, Democrat, doesn't really matter. Like, I think one of the biggest positives about Joe Biden having him in there is having a much more muscular NLRB than I think has been in place in a very, very long time. Probably since, like, the 60s, 50s, like, when the New Deal consensus was something that still held water in American politics. That's how long it's been since we've had an NLRB that's this willing to enforce the law when it comes to unionization. And when it comes to probably when it comes to killing a unionization, I mean, I'd say Howard Schultz is pretty bad, but Elon Musk is just going to be so much more blatant about it, so much more vicious. He's going to do it right out in front of everyone. And you know, honestly, I think few people are really even going to care. Elon Musk is really going to try and do everything about this, and it's really going to be up to the NLRB. Jennifer Abruzzo, who is the general counsel there, to really, you know, I'm sure she's swamped with the Starbucks situation, but Tesla is not going to go quietly here. Why has some of the country's most inspirational organizing coming out of a somewhat unfashionable corner of upstate New York? Well, the Tesla union campaign didn't just appear out of thin air in Buffalo. The organizing director of Workers United Upstate New York is headed by Gary Bonadonna Jr. This is the head of the union, is Jazz Brissac, which actually I do recognize that name. If you've been listening to the show, you may recognize that name as well. She is a 25-year-old leader who is one of the founding members of SBWU, who helps, you know, Starbucks get their union. I don't know if she's still a Starbucks worker or not. Other key members of the Starbucks union campaign have long been involved in organizing at Tesla. Longtime organizer Richard Benzinger, the founder of the AFL-CIO's Organizing Institute and a veteran of hundreds of other organizing campaigns, has also helped the Tesla union campaign, as have several other SBWU organizations, including its communications director, 26-year-old Starbucks worker, organizer Casey Moore. Bonadonna's leadership of Worker United Upstate has been critically important. Bonadonna has had the foresight to support the fledgling Starbucks union campaign when it had no national union leader in the country had showed interest in the formidable task. Bonadonna also provided innovative young worker organizers sufficient elbow room to run their own campaign and maintain their rank-and-file dynamism. The Starbucks campaign flourished in large part thanks to the local autonomy enjoyed by Bonadonna, his organizing team, and Starbucks workers in Buffalo. The movement they fostered in their corner of the woods became an inspiration, sparking a nationwide initiative. Now, it's also paying off dividends back home in Buffalo, where some of this same ethos of local autonomy extends to Tesla's Workers United, promising a vibrant organizing campaign at one of the world's wealthiest anti-union corporations. And what this really proves is that it can be done anywhere. Bonadonna has taken the view that no organizing campaign is too big or too small for Workers United Upstate New York. In addition to the headline-grabbing Starbucks and Tesla campaigns, the union has recently organized dozens of workers at two branches in Buffalo's Lexington Co-op grocery store and a small coffee chain at Remedy House, turning Buffalo into a union town. Prior to the Starbucks campaigns, Workers United Upstate New York has helped workers unionize at the Spot Coffee in Buffalo, the country's largest union coffee chain before the recent Starbucks wave, at Gimme Coffee in Ithaca, and at Pavement Coffee in Boston and Cambridge. Workers United Upstate New York's dynamic approach is just what the labor movement needs. And I think that is so, so true here. Josh Logan writing this. The labor movement, it's, you know, we keep hearing so many things about, oh, it's so positive, but, you know, things are starting to, you know, at the end of the year, we see the NLRB counting up, or the Department of Labor, whoever does it, counting up the members, the numbers of workers in the union, and then it's just a really just useless, horrific, you know, just like, the rate's going down to its lowest it's ever been, you know, like, it's not really making a dent. And this is why we need new types of people, new types of organizing, and people that have not, you know, in the past been a part of it, been a part of these unionizing efforts, and thinking of new ways to do it, which are really going to be effective, really going to kind of change the game in the situation. And I think that is really what is happening. I think the biggest step now is we've seen a huge wave of unionization kind of coming out and just growing stronger and stronger and stronger. The next thing, obviously, that we're going to need to see is a big move and a big push towards the contracts. And that is, the building a strong union means getting a contract for your employees, and getting one that, you know, the company actually accepts and respects. And it's really, really encouraging. Like, this is how change is made. This is how political parties are influenced, you know, due to the pressures of Washington, due to the reality of the kind of political system as it is, the two-party system. We got the Democrats and the Republicans are all in Washington, all surrounded by so many different negative influences that are going to push them to change from their political, you know, Bonavides or, you know, what they may have wanted to do coming into office, there has to be an active influence to match and or in some way counter the incredible influence of lobbyists, people, and pretty much status quo upholders, because there's a lot of those out there. And that is, you know, that's going to be one of the biggest challenges, probably since the 2018 Bernie Sanders movement, whatever. That has been one of the biggest areas where the left has run into trouble, which is there is no way of once these people, once, oh, yeah, AOC gets into office, but she'll get bitched at by Nancy Pelosi constantly. She'll get tons of incoming that are pushed her to be less aggressive, less radical, and, you know, less ambitious in what she's trying to do. And that is going to have, and it has had, a clear impact on the way she makes decisions, the way she moves around the house. You know, same with a bunch of other people. It's not just her. I'm just kind of picking on her because she's the most visible there. But it really has made a clear impact on a lot of different people. And the way to kind of fix that, the way to counter that, is organized labor, organized influence. Constant contact, you know, because when AOC gets a message saying, oh, can you come to this picket line, most of the time she normally does, you know, barring some of some accusations from Chris Smalls and Amazon. But she has proven that she's, you know, at least willing and open to be responsive to these requests, and having constant influence, constant contact and mobilization with those people, with, you know, voices and groups from the working class that these people are trying to represent, is going to be so helpful, and is going to give these people the spine they need, the backbone they need, to be actively radical, to be actively pushing the buttons and of power, and, you know, we're kind of as a much more effective political group, and, you know, be in constant communication too about, oh, what do you need? Oh, I need, what's the strategy here? Like, this kind of planning has been what's so missing. And I think what's really there is going to be there to take the left from, you know, one level to the next. All right. We talk Pete Buttigieg and trains in 35 seconds.
Going to park in the latest trap. Got stopped by a late cop. She got me thinking I could date a cop. Cause her uniform fit me so tight. She read me my right. She put me in a pile. She cut up all the lights. She said I have the right to remain silent. Now I got a holler. Sounding like a siren.
All right, we go now to our next story. Mayor Pete Buttigieg, a you know, very popular figure among the libs, has gotten a bit of hot water. He's been facing some pressure here, this is Jacobin Davis of Rota reporting, from lawmakers in his own party after a spate of train derailments. We talked about this. East Palestine workers have been saying it since last year, but they've been ignored by this government. Not just by Pete Buttigieg, but by Joe Biden, you know, most principally in their contract negotiations over, you know, the last few years. And that has really led to some pressure once these derailments that these workers have been trying to tell people about have actually happened. Secretary of Transportation, though, he has now suggesting falsely that he does not have the power to compel the rail industry to upgrade its safety equipment and procedures. And a Twitter thread posted more than a week after the Norfolk Southern had their fiery train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, Buttigieg indicated that he cannot reinstate an Obama-enacted, Trump-repealed law requiring some trains carrying hazardous materials to replace their Civil War-era braking systems. Yeah, again, why are these trains derailing? Because they don't want to spend money to fix their train braking systems from the Civil War era. You know, now this is going to be they want to get them to replace it with electronically controlled pneumatic ECP brake technology. We're constrained by law on some areas of rail regulation, like the braking rule withdrawn by the Trump administration in 2018 because of a law passed by Congress in 2015, Buttigieg wrote. Buttigieg's tweet refers to a law passed by Congress in 2015 at the urging of the railroad industry requiring the executive branch to conduct cost-benefit analysis of the ECP brake rule before enacting it. Trump used that law to kill the braking rule, but the cost-benefit analysis his administration used to do so was subsequently discredited. In response to questions from the Lever, a Transportation Department spokesperson said that the agencies would use all relevant authorities to ensure accountability and improve safety once the investigation into the cause for the derailment is completed. Asked about the braking rule, the spokesperson said that it would be difficult to reinstate the rule in its previous configuration given the previous legal challenges. The spokesman said that proposing a new rule would require performing a new cost-benefit analysis, though they acknowledge that the department has the ability to prepare that analysis. So the law says they got to do a cost-benefit analysis. Trump did essentially a discredited one that got rid of that rule, and now they're saying, hey, why can't, you know, Sirota is kind of asking, can't you do a good one? Can't you do a cost-benefit analysis that accurately reflects kind of what's going on here? And they're like, yeah, I guess. it's kind of what it seems here. In 2018, Senator Jeff Merkley demanded exactly that from the Transportation Department. A coalition of environmental organizations has also been asking the department to redo the analysis after a Trump administration rescinded the braking rule. Groups, including Sierra Club and Earth Justice, appealed the decision, citing flawed analysis and asking the Department of Transportation to prepare a new one. The appeal is still pending. We'd hope to see the issue move forward under the Biden administration, Kristen Boyle said, managing attorney at Earth Justice, but it's not clear that it's a priority. Rail, law, and regulatory experts interviewed by the Lever agree that Buttigieg's transport department can and should redo the analysis to allow for a reinstatement of the braking rule. The Federal Railroad Administration's mission is to promote safety, said John Rich, a retired rail worker and former legislative director of the Sheet Metal Air, Rail, and Transport Workers Union, referring to an agency within the Transportation Department. If they believe the ECP brakes are essential to rail safety, they could require ECP brakes on certain trains, or whatever they want to do. And all they got to do is just make a cost-benefit analysis saying that it's the right thing, and then they have the legal right to compel it. And Buttigieg here seems to be very, very kind of slow, to say the least, in order to doing so. All right, let's go to our next story. Railroad workers pack themselves into hotels, conference rooms, and, you know, all that stuff near the Chicago O'Hare's International Airport in June 2022 to talk fervently about a momentous event potentially on the horizon, the first industry-wide rail strike in three decades. All 12 rail unions have proclaimed themselves united, said Ron Kamenikow, the Rail Workers United General Secretary, during a conference session about choke points in the supply chain. There could be a national railroad strike for the first time in almost 30 years. Contract negotiations between the 12 unions and the country's major freight companies had ground to a halt by the conference, which was organized by RWU and the pro-union group Labor Notes, in July 99.5% of the membership of the union, representing railroad engineers, the Brotherhood of Local Engineers and Trainmen, voted to authorize a strike if the legal hurdles were cleared. The possibility presented a challenge for the Biden administration because President Joe Biden had become known as the most friendly, labor-friendly president in recent history, while a walkout threatened to paralyze the economy with a potential cost of $2 billion per day. The administration eventually negotiated a deal with union leaders and company leaders, announced September 15, 2022, requiring a significant pay rise for workers without meaningfully addressing their primary concerns, which were short staffing, which may help the train stay on the damn tracks, and, of course, the lack of paid sick days. Many elected officials and pundits lauded the deal, but it still needed to be ratified by each union's rank and file. Three unions representing the railroad workers voted for the proposed contract, while others voted down the proposed contract, while others voted for it. Then, the country's largest rail union, the Smart Transportation Division, which represents conductors and brakemen, rejected the deal, and a national rail strike was firmly on the table. Even unions that approved the deal pledged to honor any picket lines. On December 1, 2022, at Biden's urging, Congress intervened, passing a law to force the unions to agree to the deal. Many workers were furious and felt betrayed. It was very frustrating for the most pro-labor president, this is, of course, in scare quotes, America's ever had. Matt Weaver says, talking about Biden, he's the legislative director for the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees, the nation's third largest rail union. When railroads have record profits and profit margins, and yet this deal is imposed, what we've seen is that our labor is expendable. The ordeal has also led many railroad workers and industry watchers to consider a really vastly increased role for government and freight railroads nationalization. On October 5th, 2022, RWU adopted a resolution calling for public ownership of railroad infrastructure, which is operated for the public benefit. The grassroots organization brings together members from all 12 rail unions, but has no official power to negotiate with employees or the government. Its members were prominently featured in national media around the potential strike, but the group says its resolution reflects a growing demand for change among railroad workers. The resolution outlines how the rail industry has downsized one-third of its workforce, outraged shippers by jacking up prices, and failed to solicit or accept new but less profitable freight, imposed to safety measures, and took a hostile stance towards unions, among other failings. And I think, again, especially after this East Palestine situation, I think it is so much easier to see a very logical and respectable case for doing this stuff. This is causing, like, Chernobyl, like, the chickens are dying in towns all across Ohio, like, animals are dying, but the water's okay, apparently. That's a whole other kind of can of worms there, but it is really causing safety havoc all over the place. And nobody, seems to be willing to do anything. In any kind of normal country, people would be like, even in like Great Britain, people would be like, okay, this enough is enough. We got to bring this kind of under state control. They've lost the ability to run this competently. They can't do it, and we need some change. But no, in America, this is as far off as it ever could be. All right, we will be back tomorrow for another episode. It's Newsflash.